Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I'm speaking with Catherine Abreu, Executive Director of Climate Action Network. Welcome to Earth Matters, Catherine, and tell us about the Climate Action Network. It's been involved for 30 years and has over 100 organizations, but tell us a bit more.
Sure. So I run Climate Action Network Canada. Climate Action Network is an international network. In fact, it operates in about 120 countries worldwide. But each of the national and regional nodes operate autonomously. So there's Climate Action Network Canada. We are members of that international body. And here in Canada, we have 105 member organizations. Those member organizations are really diverse in the communities that they work in and also the issues that they care about. But the thing that they all hold in common, of course, is a deep concern over climate change and the ways in which a changing climate affects people and the natural world. So our members here in Canada are pretty much all the environmental organizations you could think of, plus many member organizations work in the labor movement. So Canadian Labor Congress, Unifor are examples. We have faith groups in the membership like the United Church of Canada and Citizens for Public Justice, health groups like the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, and of course, international development organizations and humanitarian groups like Oxfam and Care Canada. And those are just the household names. We, of course, also have plenty of members who are smaller scale volunteer run organizations led by passionate community members who really care about making a difference where they live. So, you know, a huge diversity there makes for really rich conversations. And I think really that's the power of a network is it brings these diverse views together. It touches on these diverse communities and it allows us to develop some joint strategies for climate action in Canada that have buy-in and reach across the silos of kind of issue areas and provincial boundaries. So we've been working in Canada for about 30 years. That's the same length of time that the international network has been operating. And we work domestically on making sure Canada does its part in the global effort to take action on climate change. And we also represent international, at international events, we represent Canadian civil society fairly regularly. So we attend all the UN climate talks and we figure out how to build and maintain Canadian civil society's presence in those spaces.
Mm-hmm. In your mission statement, you talk about and combating climate change, particularly by building social consensus for the implementation of climate change action. So how difficult is it, all those diverse groups, to reach a consensus? Is there a consensus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is consensus on a lot of issues and rich dialogue on a lot of others. So for sure, it's not easy to get everyone within 105 member organizations on the same page on every issue. But I think that's actually the power of coalitions is that even with sometimes dissenting opinions or with, you know, representatives who hold kind of different points of view coming together, we are able to actually have that consensus that has the authority of a really kind of mixed and rich dialogue behind it. So when we say that Canada's Climate Action Network has represented the interests of the Canadian climate movement as a whole rather than any one individual organization, what we mean is that each of our member organizations priorities are important to us, and we support them in, you know, amplifying their own priority messages. But where we really zero in is facilitating those challenging conversations about, for instance, you know, the future of natural resource development in Canada when it comes to oil and gas, the oil and gas sector in particular, and greenhouse gas emissions and the ways in which that impacts climate change. So you can imagine we're able to foster some really interesting conversations about whether it makes sense for Canada to invest in new fossil fuel infrastructure when we, you know, have members who are working in communities where people are perhaps wanting to build that new fossil fuel infrastructure. And we have other members working in communities where people are feeling that that fossil fuel infrastructure might infringe on their rights, might have negative impacts on the ground where they live, and being able to open up a dialogue where those communities can actually talk to one another and come to a place where we collectively say, you know, we're supporting a robust, courageous conversation about the future of the oil and gas sector in Canada. It is not appropriate, given the reality of climate change, for this country to build new fossil fuel infrastructure. And we need to have a forward-thinking conversation as a nation about what we do with our existing fossil fuel infrastructure and how we plan for the future of jobs and prosperity in this country. You know, getting to a place where these diverse communities can say that together is a really powerful place to be in.
It sounds a lot like you're doing facilitation and mediation. Am I correct in that?
That's definitely a big part of our job, but it is not the only part of our job. We have to do a lot, and I think that that's the case for many progressive civil society organizations in Canada, that we're all doing a lot with a little. So I would say the three pillars of our work, that's pillar number one, doing that facilitation, that mediation across Canada's climate movement, but also providing resources across the movement. So, you know, doing analysis of particular policies or events, creating spaces where our members can share the resources they're developing with other members, and also creating space for dialogue with non-member organizations and allied communities. So going beyond those 105 member organizations and bringing in other people and organizations in Canada who have something to say about whatever issue related to climate and clean energy we may be talking about. But the other two pillars of our work are in actually developing, commenting on, advocating for, doing government relations around domestic Canadian climate policy, and that international front that I think is one of Climate Action Network Canada's niches, building that bridge between the domestic work that's happening on climate change in Canada and that big global push for collective action that is ultimately what the world needs in order to tackle this collective problem of climate change.
I want to ask the question, is it a push or a pull? Are you proactive or reactive? Do the groups come to you and say, look, I'm trying to deal with XYZ and they've got a different opinion, can you help us out? Or is it a case of you are looking for those connections ahead of time so that it doesn't come to an impasse?
That's a great question, and it's definitely both. So we make ourselves very available to our members who could use our support in getting their message out and amplifying their work, or in making sure that the work that they're doing is accessible to enough communities that we avoid duplication of effort. So for instance, we want to be sure that if there is amazing work happening on residential energy efficiency and building retrofits in Nova Scotia, that organizations doing similar work and that have similar concerns in Alberta are learning from some of the work that's happening in Nova Scotia and vice versa. So those conversations are ones that we broker sometimes at the request of our members. And sometimes we take those conversations on proactively because we recognize that there's a need to open up those channels of communication.
And you facilitate that by, as you say, on-the-ground meetings and discussions, but also there are a number of reports, and some are written by the Climate Action Network organizations. Some are, for lack of a better term, I'll say a clearinghouse for what other people are doing so that there is that exchange. You also do, mm-hmm. one of the things that attracted me to your organization was that you have webinars and videos, both created by yourself and created by other organizations. For example, in January, you had a video with you and Eddie Perez that went to COP24, and then you turned around and sort of gave your impressions of what was going on. I found that very enlightening and interesting because obviously I couldn't go to COP24, but I wanted to know what was going on other than what I read or heard in the mainstream media. So sure. What prompted the whole web video portion as in addition to the typical written reports?
Wow, it's so affirming to know that people are consuming some of that content and benefiting from it, so thanks for letting me know. When I started this job 3 years ago, I felt that there was a need that it would be beneficial to take on some capacity building within the Canadian climate movement around specific issues. So it is, of course, the case that, the organizations that are members of Climate Action Network and those organizations that do work within the larger movement, even if they're not necessarily members, are real experts in the priority areas that they target and strategize around. So it is never the place of me or my staff to add to that expertise necessarily. We generally try to learn from the resident expertise in those organizations. But occasionally, it's clear that there are gaps in expertise, or that there are sometimes gaps in engagement around particular issues that are kind of emerging issues. And that perhaps that expertise does exist in kind of one corner of our membership or one corner of our movement, but needs to be kind of broadcast more broadly so that everyone can benefit from it and therefore have the information they need to work on that particular issue. And so we envisioned the webinars as that capacity building tool. Here's a place, a one-stop shop, 60 or 90 minutes, where you can get a download on clean energy jobs in Canada or the connections between Indigenous rights and climate action in this country. And it gives you a window into this particular topic so that you get the high level points that you need to be making in the conversations that you're having at the community level or with your elected officials. But it also opens up the door to those folks within the movement who are thinking about these things so that you know you can access them if you want to work on this more closely or if you have further questions. And I think you've hit on a kind of important newer thing that we've landed on, which is using those webinars to also pull back the curtain on some of the events that take place where major decisions related to climate action are being made that not a lot of people have access to. So we've started trying to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. From the publications side of things, you've got in 2018, you put the lobbying kit or lobbying 101 toolkit, and more mm-hmm. recently, a history of Quebec's declaration of climate emergency. Talk to me about climate emergency. It's the buzzword these days. Is it really catching on? Do people, or probably more councils, city councils and governments, do they get it when we say climate yeah. emergency?
Yeah, great question. And that summary of the climate emergency declarations in Quebec municipalities was actually put together by one of my staff members and colleague, Tika, who is our domestic lead here at Climate Action Network Canada. And she did that because we often see, having this bird's eye view, that we get to have a disconnect between some of the work happening in French-speaking Canada and the work happening in English-speaking Canada. And of course, there's incredible work happening around climate in Quebec. And so we literally did we wanted to do the translation of that work, both the linguistic translation, but also the narrative translation, so that folks in English-speaking Canada knew about what was happening on the ground there. And I would say that that example from Quebec, where, you know, over 300 municipalities in that province alone have now signed on to a declaration of climate emergency, links up with the emergence of a municipal climate caucus made up of city mayors, officials, and councillors, that has now become a bit of a internal climate-focused lobbying unit within the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, tells us that it is actually at that municipal scale where we are seeing a real recognition of the urgency of climate change and a real commitment to action. And I am feeling super inspired by that municipal leadership. I do think that many of those municipal leaders get it. I think they're not using the phrase emergency lightly. And I think they get it because it's at that scale where the impacts of climate change are most visible. So we see those impacts affecting Canadians' lives every day, whether it's, you know, folks in the north who are seeing permafrost melt and having the foundations, the literal foundations that their houses have been built on, melt. Indigenous communities who rely on traditional food stocks, seeing those food stocks disappear or change so dramatically that it's hard to adapt. Coastal communities facing the threats of rising waters and erosion, and of course wildfires are huge in many of the western parts of Canada as well as Ontario. So it's the municipal governments that are having to deal with the fallout from these impacts. And it's at that community level, at the municipal level, where the climate change solutions take effect. That's where the rubber hits the road, really, on many of the solutions that we have to take, whether it's sustainable transportation or renewable energy. So I think the cities are getting it. And something that we feel really passionately about is figuring out how to get that conversation that is very live at the municipal scale and amplify it up to the provincial and the federal level in Canada.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about, you know, the local level. The municipalities are starting to grasp the climate emergency and do things about it. But what about all of Canada, pan-Canada? What's the big picture?
Yeah, so that Pembina report is a really great example of the ways in which we partner with our members to produce resources for the larger coalition. So the kind of high level, really wonky policy expertise that Pembina houses as one of Canada's key environmental think tanks, what we partnered with them to produce this kind of analysis of several of the climate policies that were being implemented at the provincial level, and this was in 2016, that could potentially be scaled up to the federal level. And we did a bit of a ranking of those policies to try to, you know, give this analysis to the federal government that was just pulling together this pan-Canadian plan of what might work if we saw it at that larger scale. And then we had the release of the Pan-Canadian Framework on Climate Change and Clean Growth. And this is probably the most comprehensive climate plan that Canada has ever seen. Comprehensive in that it touches on almost every sector of the Canadian economy. And at the time of its release in December 2016, had the support of almost every province and territory. We have, of course, seen that change in recent months, but at that time had really remarkable buy-in across the country. That framework, it outlines over 50 policies to help drive down emissions, adapt to climate change and increase investment in clean energy and clean technology in Canada. So I would say that carbon pricing has become one of the marquee policies that is outlined in that framework, but carbon pricing is really just one of those 50 plus policies that was put down in the framework and have in the years since been developed either through policy or regulatory measures. So in the last 4 years, we have in this country made up for a significant amount of lost time when it comes to federal action on climate change, and an important foundation has been built for action moving forward. But it's far from perfect.
Well, since you've opened the door about politics, I don't want to get you in hot water too much because you've got to work with the government of the day. But you are quoted as saying it's inevitable the wind down of Canada's oil and gas industry. And one of the media outlets in Canada contacted you for a comment on Andrew Scheer, who is the leader of the opposition federally, calling Prime Minister Trudeau a high carbon hypocrite. So how do you walk around that minefield of trying to get the message across, but not to the point where you're annoying a potential political ally?
Yeah, that's a great question. Something that we are all thinking about a lot as we head into election 2019. And the major message that I have is while climate change might be a political issue, it is not a partisan issue. It should not and cannot be made a partisan issue. And I think, unfortunately, we have seen climate change turned into a political football and made into this highly polarizing debate in the last year in Canada. And what I am really committed to is ensuring that every single political party in this country understands that regardless of their partisan affiliation, they must have something very meaningful to say and a very meaningful plan to tackle climate change. And that those ideas to tackle climate change, having those meaningful plans, cuts across all parties. There's no one party over any other party that should have an advantage in making those plans concrete and in figuring out how to ensure that we address this crisis. It is unfortunately the case that because the issue of climate action has become so highly polarized in the last year, that we have, I think, you know, become a bit captured by that polarized rhetoric, and we have some work to do in order to give ourselves and the Canadian public the tools that we need to analyze the credibility of each of the party's climate platforms. And from my perspective, the number one question that we need to be asking is whether that party's climate plan is going to put this country on track to limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, because the world scientists have told us that's the temperature increase that we need to stop at if we're going to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. So that's question number one. And then for me, question number two is this plan courageous enough to help Canada and Canadians prepare for the economic realities of confronting climate change? And one of those realities is that the oil and gas economy is not going to be around forever. And we're not saying that it's going away tomorrow. We often get accused of that, us environmentalists. But I would never say that the oil and gas sector is shutting down tomorrow. What I am saying is that if we're going to take climate change seriously, if we're committed to the success of the Paris Agreement, and if we are realistic about volatile global oil markets, we know that the Canadian oil and gas sector is changing already and that we need to prepare for more changes in the future. And instead, I see us as a country doubling down on this infrastructure of the past rather than preparing for the jobs and prosperity of the future. And that's what I want to talk about. And I don't think it has really anything to do with political affiliation. This is a conversation that every Canadian needs and should be a part of.
So in the few minutes we have left, let's turn the focus to you. You obviously have been the ED for Climate Action Network for a number of years. You were previously the ED for the Ecology Action Center. What's your driving force? What's your motivation? What got you started?
So when I worked at the Ecology Action Center, heading up the climate and energy programs there, I took such pleasure from working with a number of individuals and organizations across the Atlantic provinces. So I ran the Atlantic Canada Sustainable Energy Coalition in my role at the Ecology Action Center for a number of years, had the opportunity to work with folks in each of the four Atlantic provinces, lobbying each of the four Atlantic governments to implement climate-friendly policies. And I think it is a hallmark of my career that I like to work with and in coalitions. And that's not because that's easy work. It's, in fact, often harder to do that work than to kind of go it alone and develop your own strategy that you just move forward on without necessarily consulting with a wide range of actors. But I got a lot of confirmation in my role at the Ecology Action Center, working across those provincial boundaries in Atlantic Canada, that the more I was able to support, to nurture coalitions of diverse people and organizations, the bigger the impact we were able to make. And an example of that is the amazing kind of leaps and bounds that were made in Nova Scotia when it came to the energy efficiency and renewable energy industry. And we would not have made those leaps and bounds, I don't think, had we not been able to work across the environmental community, the social justice and anti-poverty community, the private sector who were investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy projects, as well as the government institutions who were mandated to take action on those issues. And it was really in those coalition settings that we were able to make great gains. And so that's a big part of what drives me. And then I would say another big part of what drives me is a fundamental belief in the ingenuity and the worthiness of the human species. My academic background is in anthropology and in in evolutionary biology. And I think that while humans collectively sometimes make really big mistakes, we are also capable of incredible feats of creativity and creation. And I think that this problem of climate change is something that requires the very best of us as a species. And that threatens our ability to go on existing on this planet as a species in the ways that we have in the past. And so I feel really invested in doing my part to spark that creative ingenuity across humans. And that's why I came to Climate Action Network. It's a space where I get to continue that rich, effective coalition-based work, where I get to build relationships and where I get to express my beliefs in humans and my desire to see us continue flourishing.
Sounds great. Catherine, how can people find out more about Climate Action Network?
We are at climateactionnetwork.ca, and we're, of course, on all the social media channels, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter.
All right. Catherine Abreu, ED of Climate Action Network, thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thank you so much, Lawson. Pleasure to talk.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com. News and comment.com.